What of the dollar you murder for? Is that the one fighting for your soul? Or your brother's the one that you're running from? But if you got money, forget, cause I want some.
B.I.G. Welcome to the New York Times Popcast, your America's Next Top Scammer of music, news, and criticism. I'm your host, John Caramonica.
Okay, ain't nobody f***ing with my click, 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 click. Ain't nobody fresher than my mama. Click, 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 click. As I look around, they don't do it like my click, 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 click. And all these bad, bad men, they want the... Tell a bad bitch, do whatever I say. My block behind me like I'm coming out the driveway. It's grind day from Friday to next Friday. I've been up straight for 9 days, I need a spy day. Yep. She try and give me that Wu-Tang. I might let my crew bang. My crew deep in that Wu-Tang. I'm rolling with her. I'm saying, girl, you know my crew name. You know 2 Chainz. I'm pulling up in that Bruce Wayne. But I'm the villain. Man, they kneeling when I'm walking in the building. Freaky women I be feeling. From the bank accounts I'm feeling. What a feeling. Aw, oh, man, they gotta feel. Young player from the D that's killing everything that he see. But it go. Click, 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 click. Ain't nobody fresher than my mom. Click, 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 click.
That was Click by your Good Music family. There's nothing quite like belonging. Everybody wants to feel like they're a part of something. Everybody wants to feel like they're a part of a thing that maybe they're not quite able to be a part of. But wouldn't it be so nice if you could be a part of that thing? And by that thing, I mean the Fyre Festival. Everybody cheer.
Hey!
Oh my gosh, it's tough. We don't have stage directions on podcast. That maybe next season we'll have stage directions. So you guys might be aware that scamming is back in vogue. There are two documentaries about Fyre Festival, which was a spring 2017 implosion that was covered extensively and dutifully in the New York Times, of a music event in the Bahamas that was not a music event, although it was in the Bahamas, I guess. So it had one thing. It got one thing right. It did bring people to the Bahamas. There are now two competing documentaries put out in record time, or were they?
Dun, dun, dun!
There is Fyre, which is on Netflix, and then there is Fyre Fraud, which is on Hulu. They are slightly different, and we will talk about how they are different. One way in which they were useful is that it reminded me that I have a Hulu subscription. So there's that. That was good to know.
Somebody's not watching Handmaid's Tale.
Someone's not reading his credit card bills is really what's happening.
Oh, that's...
to discuss all things Fyre, both on the documentaries, but also as it was happening in real time, I really have the A-team today. It's Milena Rizek, culture reporter of the New York Times.
Hello.
Wesley Morris, critic at large.
Hi, everybody.
Aisha Harris, assistant television editor of the New York Times.
Hello.
Squad is here. Everybody has absorbed the scammery. I said this before we started recording. I just want to say up front and emphasize my big takeaway from the documentaries and also just from America is that scams are great. And I'm assuredly pro-scam. In this moment,
do
I feel
tell.
Like that guy on YouTube who's like, I believe this thing convinced me otherwise. So that's I'm just gonna be like, scams are great. Convince me otherwise. Now you guys have an hour. Go.
No, I'm not an economist. That's not my job. No,
okay, I don't know. So anyway, I think scams are great. And I really enjoyed watching the scammery and the being scammed in these documentaries. Let's talk, Wesley. You wrote about the documentaries as art.
Okay,
hashtag,
sure.
As hashtag art? Hashtag film?
As things that happened on streaming services.
Yes, okay. Yes. So can you talk us a little bit through the distinctions between the films and kind of what you perceived as the successes and failures of each?
I should first start by saying one documentary plus one documentary still doesn't equal a whole story to me. Sure. I feel like there's a way to tell the story from outer space that also can account for all of the sort of granular stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But
and also that, I think there's a lot missing from these documentaries I have a list of.
Right.
That
there's
I
a lot.
Like,
there's a lot.
Considering there's two film crews working on this, I'm like, y'all really missed a lot.
So. Well, because they were, well, I don't want to say because they were rushing, but we can get into the ethics of
Russian?
Both these movies.
They were, oh my God, I didn't know they were Russian.
Oh Oh my God, Dad.
Yeah, sorry.
Who let you in the room?
I'm wearing a tie-dye cyber shirt. I'm allowed to say something weird today. It's fine.
Anyway, the Netflix documentary Fire is the one that I think moves the best.
It's directed by Chris Smith.
Or is the one that's better assembled, better, more streamlined, and it's the one that gets you from inception mm-hmm. to catastrophe in the most involving way.
And also in a very linear way.
Right.
I think.
It's very straightforward. But that said, it is like an express train to Schadenfreude, right? Mm-hmm. Like all of the questions that I have about how, like at various stops along the way, that this isn't stopping in New Rochelle and mm-hmm. I need it to, right? Like I would have liked to have known more about a bunch of other things that some of those questions get answered by the other movie, which I think is more comprehensive in its. Or it's an attempt to try to contextualize the scam, the people involved in the scam, the reason the people who were scammed wanted to go mm-hmm. to the Fyre Festival in the first place, and then to try to account for the sort of cultural and social response to all these people being built.
So mm-hmm. Fyre was kind of the live briefing.
Ooh.
And
yes. Ooh.
Then
yes.
The Fyre Fraud is like the, okay, we're going to analyze this and give you, it's a think piece
yeah.
like after it's all happened.
It's the think,
wow,
yeah. It's,
coming through with the journalism.
I'm just saying.
Oh my
that's
gosh.
Kind of how I thought about
that's
it.
That's deeply accurate.
That's exactly right. But I also think that neither movie goes far enough in terms of what else there is, the other questions I have. I mean, the one thing about the first movie is that you want somebody to explain Billy McFarland in a way that helps you understand things that people say about him, which is that he was charismatic and mm-hmm. he was convincing and absorbing. And if he said something, you wanted to do it. You wanted to make this guy's dreams come true. I didn't
seem like a
galoot. See that person. Right.
He seemed like a literal.
He didn't
galoot.
Even come across that way in the Hulu doc in which right. he actually appeared.
Yes.
You're like, really? This guy was the seller? This guy was the closer? It's hard to fathom.
But isn't it just that he's like a white dude? Because that's what I got out of it. Is that like you can be somewhat well off? Like I don't know how wealthy his parents were to begin with, but like you can present yourself as like a Murray Hill prototype and talk a lot of game, and then you know people will just believe you and give you money. Like, isn't that kind of what Silicon Valley is?
If you're in the yeah. right yeah. age Again. Frame for it, yeah.
yeah
I mean, it helped that he had started selling, you know, creating quote unquote tech companies as a teenager and college student, and had that arrived in the city with that rep at the moment when that was all kind of burgeoning.
Right.
There are people who I think are gravitationally attracted to people with money.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that we see that in all of the respective worlds that we operate in. So, you know, Billy McFarland felt like a very relatable character in the sense that, like, I feel like we all know 100 Billy McFarlands who are maybe not quite as ambitious or successful or like exponentially to the 10th power as him. But like, who among us doesn't know a few successful, moderately successful scammers? And yeah, I think him being like, I don't want to say a handsome white guy. Eh. I don't find, yeah, exactly. Right. Like a guy with good, a white guy with good shoulders,
who wears
maybe?
Polos
not short.
Not,
not,
not short.
Not short.
Not short.
Not short. Not short. Exactly. Not
short. Right.
Yeah. he's got a block. He's not like, I mean, I think I literally wrote this. He's not handsome.
Right.
Right. Like he's
kind of nerdy looking.
There's something about him. There's nothing about him, actually. Do you know what I mean?
The comparison that we got when we were writing the story as the festival was falling apart and in the aftermath was one of the sources who knew him, who said there was a movie, I think it was called War Dogs, that came out before that with Miles Teller and Jonah Hill. And Billy, as you know, if you've watched these two docs, had this partner in crime, this shorter person named Grant. And the source was like, this was those two guys. Billy was Miles Teller. Jonah Hill was Grant. I mean, you couldn't, at the time he said, you can't make a movie about this because it's already been done. War Dogs, which was a movie about these two 20-something white guys who had a an audacious scam to like sell arms.
You mean two of the finest actors of their generation?
That's a different conversation.
Is that the film you're speaking of? That War Dogs?
Well, it bombed no matter what.
Right.
While we're there, so Milena, you were part of the luxurious reporting team that dealt with fire in real time. So can we maybe sort of pull back for a minute and remember what it was like all the way back in April of 2017, when this was starting to unfold on social media and kind of what reporting on it looked like.
That's right. We started to catch it. You know, I think Joe Coscarelli, who you know and love on this podcast, had been following as a, you know, as a music reporter, because the reports had already been out in the press that maybe this was a troubled music festival before the Schadenfreude hit social media. And then as that stuff started coming out, we took stock of what was going on in the festival and wrote a couple stories where we talked to some of the attendees. I talked to a woman who sort of described what we later saw in the docs about, you know, people like that mad dash for the wet mattresses and like piles of Amazon boxes everywhere and just the general disarray. So I was getting that report, you know, in real time from that woman. I think she might have still been in the Bahamas because she ended up staying at another hotel while afterwards. And then we took a couple of weeks and did that, you know, bigger analysis and investigative piece of what really happened, how this came to be, how it was tied up with the Fire app, you know, what some of the financial malfeasance was, and what the, I think really importantly, what the impact was on the Bahamian workers who were like busting their butts for weeks and months trying to pull this thing together.
Unpaid.
Eventually, yeah.
Still unpaid.
Yeah. Right.
That's the saddest part of all of this. Like, I was all in for the Schadenfreude. Like you, I'm all about scammers, as long as the scamming is happening to, like, well-off people.
Right.
And for the most part, that is...
Or people who just should know better with their so-called disposable income.
Yes, yes. Although, like, look, I remember when the ad first dropped online for the Fire Festival. And I remember my fiancé, like, he was like, hey, look at this. This looks really cool. And I was like... Yeah, I mean, it looks kind of cool.
Wait,
like,
you almost went to Fire? Oh, my
no,
God.
No, I did not. But he was like, this looks really cool. And I'm like, yeah, you know, but Pablo Escobar, what? And then I was like, how much does a tent cost? Like, and I was like, no. But then there's so many people who were just like, yeah, I'm going to sell all my belongings just to go to this, like, hip thing. And those people I don't understand.
Those people clearly have not read our ongoing coverage about the decline of the American festival. So I just I wonder if anyone's listening and
so
thinking of going to another version of this, I'd like to refer you to some article we wrote in 2013.
But John, I do want to come back to that idea, though, because I do think that it is a question that I have for you guys as a person who would never, ever, 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 ever go to a music festival.
Yeah. Same. Except for Beyonce at Coachella, obviously.
I wouldn't even have gone to that because I would have had to get out of there somehow.
Should we take a 5-minute sidebar and tell you how long it took me to get from the Beyonce Coachella set to my hotel room?
4 hours.
Because it'll take 5 minutes for me to tell you the whole story.
Yeah. I mean, see, this is why I don't want to go. But
I'm PTSDing just thinking about it.
But to go back to like this question of who the actual victims were in this story. Mm-hmm. There is attention paid to the repercussions for groups of people. And the Netflix movie does have the woman who runs the restaurant.
Yes.
Marianne Roll.
Yes.
Who I spoke to.
And she's just a compelling person because she's one of the most inarguably wronged people. Like, I would say innocent bystander in a lot of ways, but also kind, compassionate.
And generous. Like, she was just like, all these people showed up. Of course I'm going to feed them at cost to myself and then also pay people out of my own savings. But no, to build on that, it was really striking how even the people who worked for Billy and Fire, who were sort of like the common sense folks in the Netflix documentary, still seem like scammers, even though they were sort of like, we understand, like, we could have done it differently. The only people who I thought had any like moral weight in this entire ecosystem of two films were all of the workers. And to be honest, there weren't nearly enough people.
I wouldn't even say all, because the foremen, I don't know.
Oh, you think?
I just feel like
You think he caught a check and...
I don't know if he got paid, but I think he knows more about
which one? Winther?
I think there are two different...
J.R. or Delroy?
I think about the fixers.
Yes.
The Bahamian fixers.
Yes. Yeah.
Well, the thing I think that was underrepresented in both films, was touched on in one of them was that, you know, as much as they oversold the festival to the attendees, they also oversold it to the Bahamians because mm-hmm. they told them this was going to be a multi-year event. So, for example, Marianne Roll thought, okay, you know, maybe they're going to screw up this first weekend. They'll get it right the second weekend. Next year, it'll be amazing, right? They had planned that this was going to be a multi-year extravaganza for their, you know, comparatively struggling community. So some of these people who continued working or continued trying to fix things up were probably buoyed along by the thought that, first of all, they got paid some portion of their money at the moment and then, you know, upfront, and then a larger portion when the event happened. So they were like trying to, you know, hold out for that. But also Billy would sometimes roll up with like wads of wet $100 bills in his pocket because he'd been jet skiing all day and hand that out. So they thought, okay, this guy's going to be flush at some point.
While we're speaking about unfortunate power dynamics and poor ethical relationships between white Americans and Caribbean folk, let's listen to Major Lazer. Watch out for the watch out for this. Boom, my
segue.
Podcast is over now. I just
Postscript. I don't know if you guys know about Marianne Roll and her Kickstarter.
Mm-hmm. GoFundMe.
Oh, GoFundMe. Sorry. Yeah. It's up to 175, yeah. I think. I mean, the last time I checked, which was like a day ago.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, there is some good to come. I mean, I don't know if there's probably some other good, but I don't know if, like, she said she lost $50,000. She's made this much. I don't know if there are funds for the laborers who actually right. tried to
There's
build
another
some of these.
GoFundMe okay. that's laborer focused, but not very many, at least when I checked yesterday, not very many people had donated to it.
Okay.
So maybe there can be some kind of union of the funds. I, you know, my fear is that the disbursement of those funds will then come with their own dramas that will then, you know, once again, re-victimize the people who are meant to be helped.
And one other thing about the workers, like we're talking about the Bahamian workers who obviously were key to getting this production as much off the ground as it got, but also the production staff, you know, a lot of them were people imported from the U.S. from Miami mm-hmm. and you know, cycled through as the thing got increasingly fraught. I mean, they were put out. They lost money, too. And, you know, perhaps their stories are not necessarily as, you know, sympathetic because they're mm-hmm. not like local workers. They're like Miami sound guys. But, you know, like Luca Sabatini, the production designer who was interviewed in the Netflix doc, mm-hmm. who was also one of the people I spoke to early on, you know, when you look at that picture of pictures of the stage actually looks legit. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Like that guy mm-hmm. did a good job, you know, the lighting ring, all that stuff. And then that stuff was stuck in customs, all his gear for, you know, weeks and months on end afterwards because the fire guys never paid the customs people, as we memorably learned they had some weird interactions with the customs folks.
You mean someone didn't go down on
oh
someone?
Oh my
else?
God!
Is that what happened?
Oh my lord! The
Not
Evian,
a detail we could get in the New York Times story.
Yeah. Worth the price of my Hulu subscription or Netflix, whichever subscription.
That's the
it was.
Netflix one.
Okay,
yeah. And I things like that in the first movie really irritate me because I do feel like one of the things that's really missing is follow up questions with mm-hmm. all of these people. It's like, I'm going to tell you what I did, and we're going to take what you said and put that into the, that's going to be a
in
car
the record.
On the, right.
Yeah.
And I feel like that was an opportunity to ask this guy, well, what about Billy made okay. you want to humiliate yourself. And then you're telling us, you're still telling us, I now know that you, sir, were willing to go down on some dude at Customs to help this fool out.
Just as a sidebar, do you think the guy in Customs knew about
that? Like, there's no way.
Do you think that guy watched the Netflix documentary and was like, oh, it's my friend, it's my guy. I wonder what he's going to say.
I missed out on something.
And then,
here.
Like, 45 seconds later, like, so just curious, anyway, if the guy who works in customs is listening to podcasts, send us an email, podcast@nytimes.com, and let us know if you were caught off guard by that particular
revelation. There was really a shortage of Bahamian officials in both of these docs.
Right.
Like, yes. These guys had to get approval from various, mm-hmm. you know, cultural ministries, tourism, whatever, those folks were around, like. Where was their voice in these telling these
stories?
Well,
that's the thing. I felt like I need a whole separate documentary on what was happening on the ground in the Bahamas. Because with locals. Because I feel like that, apart from the fixers and a couple workers and the woman who was the chef, it just felt like it was the footnote to the Billy story. But that, to me, feels like a very rich, ripe subject matter.
Yeah, everyone I talked to on the Bahamian end was like, oh, we all told him this is not going to happen.
Well, right. I feel like, but that to me is in the movie. I mean, there is a like an interesting cultural shorthand that comes through, and it's part of the. I think that's part of the sort of international Schadenfreude mm-hmm. that people feel for the people who showed up for the show, because there is something that you don't have to really have a lot of. You don't have to have a lot of time having black people just be like. No.
Nah.
This is not going to work. A little bit of that, because we all feel it. That is why these movies are as popular as they are. That's why after this happened, your stories were like the most read things on the site for how many days? I feel like it's a really interesting moment to think about what these movies and this scam represent.
But also the why, and to go back to your question from a minute ago about the why, because again, the people, especially in the first film, were not pressed on that. And we should say that the first film, the Netflix film, I guess released second technically, but the one that was announced first, was made in partnership with Jerry. I'm gonna say Jerry like 40 times. So I'll be as surprised as everybody else when I find out how the multiple mentions of Jerry are handled. But Jerry's social media agency, Elliot Tabele, is the guy who runs it and ran the meme account that turned into a social media agency, who curiously did not appear in the documentary. While we're out here naming names. But a lot of his people did, and they also contributed footage, I guess, that they had. It's worth saying that Netflix feels much more polished.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And I think it's polished because they have access to this footage.
Right.
We have all the kind of root component parts that successfully scammed you in the first place. Now, here we've put together a kind of like postmortem with the same slightly greasy, oily.
You talking
ethos.
About Vice? What? Where is this going?
Speak on it, Melena. Say what you feel.
Well, Vice was also a producer of the Netflix documentary, and you know, talking about promoting influencer culture and party heavy bros. I mean, you can't really disassociate some of that stuff from what we saw happening on those beaches at Fyre.
Absolutely. Do you feel like the Vice Jerry combination, as opposed to sort of what Aisha described as like the think PC approach in the Hulu documentary? Obviously, ethical perspective, it's troubled, but both of them have ethical issues.
Both of them had ethical issues. That's true. For me, the Netflix doc, I kind of disagree with you guys. I found it less interesting and successful, maybe because I knew some of those details already going in about mm-hmm. what happened in the production level of the festival.
I think the Hulu one is better.
Yeah, the Hulu one is better.
My personal feelings is the Hulu one is better. The mm-hmm. first one moves better, but the Hulu one is where all, like, any ideas that there are about what happened.
The first one still feels, the Netflix one still feels like a commercial for Fyre Festival. Right.
Oh, and certainly for the social media agencies that made the doc.
You think Jerry's billables about to go through the roof in 2019?
Or are they going to be targeted by more lawsuits? I don't know.
I don't know. Kids, don't start Twitter accounts. Don't be funny on Twitter. Please. It just doesn't end well. Let's talk a little bit about the Hulu documentary. We were just talking about the ethical implications before we switch over, speaking of the Hulu documentary.
What the hell is ADD? My friends say I should act my age. What's my age again? What's my age again? But later on the drive home, I called her mom from a payphone. I said I was the cops and your husband's in jail. The state looks down on sodomy. And that's about the time that bitch hung up on me. Nobody likes you when you're 23.
Billy McFarlane is the guy who is responsible for all the trauma, and he is alluded to and dragged in the Netflix documentary, and alluded to and dragged and also interviewed in the Hulu documentary. Apparently, he was paid by the producers for a combination of what seemed like a reasonably challenging day of interviews and some footage, although his footage was not as good as the Jerry Netflix footage. I was sort of mildly heartened to see that they asked him challenging questions, that they included the kind of meta narrative of the producers interrogating him, of him getting up and walking out. And I had heard that he had been paid before I watched the documentary, so I was nervous that it was going to be a little bit more hagiographical, but it seems that they confronted him. I mean, he also seems like a person incapable of self-analysis, but I do like that the criticism aspect of the Hulu film functioned in two ways. One, you have all these outside voices sort of talking about, from now on, every documentary has to have 5 minutes of Gia Tolentino in it. It's a rule, every single one. So there's that. But it also has the criticism built in of Billy, even though they've paid him TK dollars to be there. What did you guys think of Billy as like a living character, as opposed to kind of like just a dude in snapshots on a jet ski?
I mean, to me, he just came off exactly like I imagined him coming off in the Netflix doc, which I watched first before I watched the Hulu doc. He fulfilled all of my nightmares about what he would be like. And I do agree with you that I think that the fact that they really didn't let him, you know, get away with not answering questions, or like, you know, he had to like get up and say like, I'm done. But like, he is just so delusional. Like the word that kept coming up to me was like just delusion, because
he really believed the thing in his head. Like he really like.
Right. Which doesn't make him any less evil. I think I think he knew exactly what he was doing, but he also was able to like completely tamp it down outside of everything. And so, yeah, he just came off looking really bad in the Netflix doc and like really, really bad. Well, no, that's not true, because in the Netflix doc, they also have towards the end. I can't remember how they got this footage, but him like actually conducting the scam that they only mention in the Hulu doc.
Yeah, right.
Like on camera. They have, really I forget what the new scam was.
NYC VIP.
Yeah, where they were selling like
exclusive access to a famous person.
It was similar
person.
To what he was doing with Magnesis, his business that preceded his business, quote unquote, that preceded Fire.
Hey, if you guys where subscribe to Popcast, I will get you tickets to the Grammys.
What about the Met? The Met Ball.
You have to subscribe to Popcast and Still Processing.
Done!
Wesley and I will personally escort you to the Met Gala.
If you subscribe. Yes. See, that's, I mean, and for people who hear that, I mean, but it wasn't that different, this other company, right? Like, the things that they were offering were basically...
It was just like, a new name.
A shopping spree with Kanye.
Yeah, it was similar. I mean, the best.
I've done it. I don't need no Magnesis card.
One of my favorite details from the reporting that we did in the lead up to explain like who he was and how he got to fire is that he, you know, for people who were Magnesis members, he would randomly text them in these like group texts and offer weird stuff for sale, like take a ride in my Lamborghini, five spots left, you know, $500 a piece. And it was clear like the guy was strapped for cash and he was trying to do anything he could to raise money. But like, I am an immigrant and I appreciate a hustle. And that's like, okay, you have a Lamborghini. Sure, you can sell a ride in it for $500. That's a hustle. That's a proper
it's
hustle.
Like Airbnb, but it's also being your Lamborghini.
But he also offered to have your name mentioned in a Ja Rule song. Which
how have we gone this long without even mentioning Ja?
That's actually
where
really
is Ja?
Okay, that's a good question. Let's play the entire recorded catalog of Ja Rule.
Oh boy.
What's my name?
Okay, so Ja Rule would like to remind you to live like a rock star. I'm just not going to do it. Ja Rule went on Twitter a couple days ago to let you know that he, too, has been hoodwinked and bamboozled. He is also launching basically a Fire-like app with the other guy who somehow gets no play in the Hulu documentary and like comes off as like a reasonable person in the Netflix documentary. They're doing like their own app. Who knows where maybe Billy's like.
Wait, this isn't Grant.
No, it's M. David or M. David or that's they Beardy. Have a new company.
Beardy? One of the Beardies?
Yes.
Right. Not the yoga Beardy. The other. Okay, Ja Rule, hoodwinked, bamboozled or no? Or fully aware?
You know, you can judge for yourself based on even the footage of Ja being on the site at various times, being on those business meetings,
the
being on those
calls.
Yeah, the calls with various, you know, both investors scrambling for more cash and the production people who are, you know, repeatedly telling them cancel, do anything you can to cancel this. So I think you can judge for yourself about what level of involvement he had. And I think hoodwinked is by far a stretch.
In the Hulu documentary, I did find it mildly, I don't know if like heartwarming or charming, I'm not sure what the adjective is, but like when the interviewer tries to get Billy McFarlane to like implicate Ja.
Oh yeah, throw Ja under
and
the bus,
he will not do it. Now, obviously he won't do it because he understands the power of celebrity. He doesn't want to like drag a celebrity because he may need a celebrity. But there was also some kind of perverse like, no, you don't get to take Ja Rule down. Yeah. I'll eat this. It's my
party. Or maybe he's just savvy and just knows Ja Rule will find a way to incriminate his own self.
Wow.
I mean, he does it like three times between two movies.
Yeah.
Like damning footage where he, like, I don't know why this guy has not been indicted or accused. Or like,
did he snitch?
Where are the other people?
50,
like, this is the question
50,
I
did
have.
Ja snitch? While we're here, I just feel like,
listen, we don't have time.
And also, Ja's been to jail. Ja just came out of jail.
For tax fraud.
I'm sorry.
For tax fraud.
Relevant, Your Honor.
I'm sorry.
I did like the one guy in the I don't remember who it was, but he was like, yeah, when Billy said Ja Rule was on board, and he was saying in the most sarcastic way, it's like, I
his
was
sarcasm didn't work, though, right?
Because sometimes he sarcastic?
I thought it was sarcastic.
I'm not sure.
He was that smiling. One guy
that was in both docs.
Maybe I'm projecting.
The red flag. The red flag waiver. Yeah.
Maybe I was projecting. I thought he was sarcastic.
He was being sarcastic, but I mean, it was always one of those things where he would say something and I'd be like, wait a minute. You guys don't know that he's not funny, but I do have a question before. Can I just ask one more question? Yeah. What about everybody else? I mean, it can't just be that this one guy is going to take the, I mean, he's the most responsible, but he's not the only responsible person for that scam.
That's right. And some of the investors were named in lawsuits. I mean, it's absolutely clear that Billy had enablers, you know. I think, you know, to all of our questions of like, what was it about this guy that's purported to be so charming that, you know, got people like Carola Jane, a pretty big investor and the wife of another big investor on board. I mean, that's a question that is hard to answer without having the ability to really like spend a lot of time with Billy McFarland, which, you know, I don't know if anybody wants to or can do that now that he's in jail, but like he definitely had enablers. That's something that we heard when we were doing our reporting. There were high level enablers, people who were funneling him money. There were sort of medium level enablers, some of the executives around him who were sort of acting as yes men and telling him, like, this will pull this off, whatever, or it won't matter if it's not quite the same. It's absolutely true. And, you know, he's savvy enough to say it himself. In one of the movies, he says, you know, so many things had to go right for us to fail this big, or some version of that.
Good,
right?
Really, it was. I thought that was a very good. That was like as close as he came to being self-aware. I thought that was like a really good.
But that was
good line.
That was part of what motivated all of them, right? Like even the designers and the social media team and all of them was like, yeah, like this is all a cluster, whatever. Yes. But
cluster, Jerry.
Yes, a cluster. But what if we do pull this off? Then we can go back and say. We just pulled off the most impossible thing ever. And I feel like that was part of what was driving so many of those people to just keep saying, even though all the red flags were there, and even though there was, they were like, I don't know if this is going to happen, they still kept going.
Let's listen to Walk It, Talk It.
Hey, Walk It, Like I Talk It. Walk It, Like I Talk It.
Yes.
Walk It, Like I Talk It. Walk It, Like I Talk It. Talk It. Walk it like I talk it. Ay. Walk it like I talk it. Walk it like I talk it. Yeah. Take my shoes and walk a mile, something that you can't do. Woo. Hey. Big tops of the town, big boy gang moves. Gang moves. I like to walk around with my chain loose. Chain, chain. She just bought a new, but got the same booze. Same booze. Whipping up dope scientists. Whip it up, cook it up, That's my sauce where you find it. That's my sauce when you look it up, find it. Adding up checks, no minus. Adding up, add it up, add it up, add it up. Yeah. Get your respect in diamonds. Ice, ice. I bought a plane, Jane, roll it, did bought they fame. Woo. I think my back got scoliosis, cause I swerved the lane. Heard you signed your life for that brand new chain. I heard. Think it came with stripes, but you ain't straight with the game. Gang, gang. Walk it like I talk it. Walk it. Walk it like I talk it. Walk it. Walk it like I talk it. Talk it. Walk it like I talk it. Woo. Walk it like I talk it. Walk it. Walk it like I talk it. Walk it. Walk it like I talk it. Talk it. Walk it like I talk it.
Let's go.
Okay, so to pick up on your point, let's talk about scams. We've had a lot of scams for the last 2-3 years, very public. We have scams in American popular culture. We have scams in politics, global politics. We got scams in New York nightlife. People are really enjoying scams. But I want to pick up on this idea of why everybody bought in. And were they buying into Billy? Were they buying into the idea? And I was saying before, like, who among us doesn't know a scammer here and there? Totally, totally reasonable thing, I think, when you look at anyone's friend or associate circle. But I also think so many things that turned out to be important, interesting, transformative events probably started off a little scam-like, a little hustle-like, whether it's pulling together a budget for a weird film or putting, you know, putting out and out, like, you know, recording music sort of on a lark that's like, oh, I guess if I can convince people I'm a musician, maybe I'll actually become a musician. There is an element of falseness that I think underlies a lot of cultural production in the world. How different is the kind of like, I'm going to fake it till I make it in the worlds of art or film or music or any of that? How different is that from we're going to throw this festival and like sheer force of will pull it together and sort of almost do. Oh, because I hit the thing. How different is that from pulling together a festival and saying by sheer force of will, we're going to do it and actually kind of getting 75% of the way there? Aren't there, isn't the road littered with 75% of the way concepts? Not that I advocate stranding a bunch of influencers on a random island.
I think you do.
Okay.
That's their own
maybe
fault.
Maybe via a different mechanism. But I guess what I'm saying is the sort of underlying scamminess of it felt very familiar to me from like a lot of like strivers I know in music who are like basically faking it until they make it and like advertising themselves one way but really being another way. That part didn't feel false to me. That part felt really, or even offensive. it kind of felt familiar. Now, maybe that's depressing.
Do you mean talent, though? Like faking your talent? Because that's different from faking, like, having money to pay people.
It's maybe faking your success.
Right.
It's maybe faking your success level, or like it's faking that you are taken seriously or known when you are not yet taken seriously.
Well, that's true, because you can buy Instagram followers. Mm-hmm. You can buy whatever. I'm going to out myself as I watch a lot of Catfish.
Oh, I thought you were going to say you bought Instagram followers.
No. I've never.
So many. So many details.
I've got like 100.
I've been waiting to meet one of you.
But like, I watch a lot of Catfish, and that's like, even that is a very, the MTV show is a very scammy thing, and you're convincing other people to believe in it. So I do agree that that's a thing. But like, I don't know, faking it until you make it just feels very different from actually like hoodwinking people into believing that like you have something other than talent or like success to give them. Like when we're talking cold hard cash, that's like very different.
One area where I thought both of the docs kind of fell down is like they shoved a lot of blame on influencers and influencer culture.
Yeah, I just wasn't going for that.
About, you know, why these things, certainly why like this festival attracted so many people and why it was such a failure. And that is just flat out wrong.
Yeah.
Like actively and creatively and interestingly selling a festival is not wrong. Like the fact that those folks figured out a way to attract all those people.
Bella Hadid doesn't need to apologize.
There's nothing wrong with that. You know what I mean? Like that their marketing did not live up to what they were selling. I mean, there's degrees of truth in every time you see an ad. Or have you seen a movie promo recently? I mean, none of that stuff is exactly the thing that it's selling, and that's not illegal. The fault is not with the influencers or the marketing people who were savvy. I mean, maybe with some of the marketing people.
But definitely with the marketing people.
Yeah, sure. But like definitely the distance from reality was problematic. But the fact
she
that
she was
they
a
were
spokesmodel.
Like,
she wasn't the person who came up with the marketing campaign.
No, and there is the two. And it's important to remember, we haven't sort of explicitly said this. There were things happening on two parallel tracks during the build up to the weekend of the festival. One, what's happening on the island, which, as you can tell from all the footage in both documentaries, is sort of like an unremitting disaster in the making. But what's happening on social media, which is how everybody is experiencing what they think is going to happen, smooth sailing. It's clear blue waters. It's, you know, it's people climbing trees and having great times and drinking fancy colored beverages. And
yeah,
that's where the Jerry stuff really comes in. Because if you worked for that company and the guys you saw, they landed on the island maybe a week before and look around and be like, this is nuts. Like, at some point, you have to accept that what you are putting into the world is genuinely fraudulent. If you're doing it from your New York office, maybe, or your LA office, maybe you get a half pass.
You don't get any pass. You still don't get a pass because you have due diligence if you're selling something to go actually look and see what you're selling people.
Vet that stuff. Like, should they be held to the same degree of accountability as everyone directly involved? No. But, like, Kendall Jenner's team or whatever should have, like, done more, looking into who this guy was.
Next, you're going to want companies that like make cigarette advertisements to like be really skeptical about. I mean, like, what's next?
It's a slippery slope. It's a very slippery slope, I know.
But I don't think you can blame influencer culture for this being a disaster.
No, but they use, obviously, the nature of influencer culture to convince people. Like, that's the
thing. That they want to go.
It's not that influencers are the problem. It's more that the ecosystem that creates the thing. What is the thing that Billy says early in the Netflix documentary? Like, it's basically like for the average loser to, it's like the average loser's vision of what they would want or something along those lines.
Yeah.
That's in essence what he's taking advantage of. And we haven't talked a lot about the people who actually were scammed by coming to the island, but like all those people wanted a thing. They wanted the Bella Hadid, Kendall Jenner, Chanel Iman thing, whatever that was. They were all after that. And that's what they were denied. Now, whether that's like a viable thing to want.
But that's just advertising.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Like, who can blame them for being susceptible to like smart, sexy advertising? That's what it's there for.
But if you sell all of your belongings, as some people claim, claimed they did. I don't know if this is true or not, but you know, that those were the complaints hurled after the fact. But if you like, you sell all of your belongings or like can't pay rent to do that, I'm sorry. Like,
you've
priorities.
Lost, you've lost Aisha. Yeah.
You've lost me.
Let's listen to Ray Schremer. Keep the change. Yeah, you heard me correctly. If she's sleeking foreign, call Alexis. Every week of foreign, I just check a wish list. Only thing I'm here for is perplexing. Caterpillar whip, and I lowered it. Lil Jim, I got a problem. I'm in love with money, I'm in love with balling. Gotta keep my phone on vibrate, how these just call it. Neiman Marcus Shawty, and I ain't win no shopping. 2K on my feet, yeah, 2K, I be kicking game. Bubble gum OG, I'm smoking on a different strain. We still in South, they need to stay off in their lane. Baby, we on top and that ain't never gonna change. Put you boys to shame. Pull them boys out and put you boys to shame. Going hard on them like Major Pain. Say my name, they ain't know how to spell it, so I put it on my chain. Jump in the Pegasus.
They were all gonna be there. This is just so crazy to me. Where were they gonna stay?
Yes.
Like, well,
also, how did that one influencer actually get a villa?
No, they did have actual fancy housing for the fancy people.
What about the box of house keys that was $2 million for the
But like the influencers, there was a
keep
boat.
All my house
there
keys
was
in a box.
There
that
was
I kinda
a fancy
lose.
House. I mean, those people were treated well fancily because he knew whose you know, side
videos counted.
Right, exactly.
The look of quasi-guilt on that one young woman's face where she's like, I'm in the villa.
Right.
I'm sorry.
Quasi, heavy on the quasi.
That British lady?
No, no, not the British lady. Alyssa. Coco.
The one who couldn't describe her brand.
Yeah. Right. She's like, wellness. Positive. I would like to say Popcast is also about wellness and positivity. And we are looking for sponsors.
Listen. I have a question for you guys, though. You know, these things are happening at the same time. They happen within day. They arrive within days of each other. What? Why now? And why does one? Why were they? I mean, to the degree that they were in a race at all, why were they racing? And what harm would there be in a version that like explicitly and more thoroughly involved the participation of the work that you and Joe Coscarelli did, Milena. Yeah, and Ben Cesario. And, like, really think about what this is and what it means and what story it... I mean, there's obviously plenty of time and room for somebody based on the popularity of these two movies to really think about this festival and, like, the cultural atmosphere around it. Because I just had a lot of questions about festivals. I had a lot of questions about, like, really what it is to experience FOMO. Not for someone to tell me what FOMO is, but, like, to really, like, think about, like, how this is any different from having to be somewhere 30 years ago. And what if in any way this is different, or how in any way if this is different, is this different from... like other sort of mass culture phenomena. I don't know. But I don't know why we needed to have these two. I don't know why like Usain Bolt and Ben Johnson to mix my Olympic years had to sprint to the finish line now.
I have two thoughts.
Okay.
One is, you know how like a Burger King always opens across the street from McDonald's?
Yes.
Because it grows business for both.
Right.
Coney Island Avenue and Avenue U. McDonald's on one side, Burger King on the other side. I was very pumped when the Burger King opened because I wasn't messing with McDonald's in the early 80s. When Burger King opened, it was popping.
Listen to him.
But you know, like that's a marketing thing. It's like you they're competitors, but it's co-optition.
Let me just say again, I'm not an economist. I don't know what you're talking about. Okay. But I hear you. It sounds dumb to me.
I took micro and macroeconomics. It's cooperation and competition all happening at the same time. So I do think there's that. The other part, and this is something I was actually hoping you guys could speak a little bit more to, because it was something that I thought about, but I don't know if I have the language or the tools to really grasp. We are about to be, I think, in an age of a lot of these kind of like rushed documentaries, because the nature, I think, of documentary is changing because of social media, because of the availability of footage, the ubiquity, the sort of Rashomon like 96 perspectives. I mean, you see this happening right now with the Covington high school students, where every day there's another person coming out with a different angle, trying to change the narrative. I think documentary making a lot of times is about, like, can we dig something up that people haven't seen before? But now people have seen everything. And I think there's going to be this move in documentary, broadly speaking, towards organizing and aggregating things that are widely available and unruly. And that's how these documentaries felt to me. I wonder, from a filmic and televisual perspective, is this something that you feel is happening, or do you think it's fundamentally different from how documentary was made 3 years ago, 5 years ago, 12 years ago?
I think documentary is going through a total sea change. It's something I've written about a little bit, exactly for the reasons you described, John, because, you know, of the availability of footage, of the fact that, like, anyone feels they can jump in and make a documentary right now. And it's leading to a lot of questions that are interesting for documentary filmmakers about what role they have. Some people viewed themselves as sort of journalists and filled important roles, especially as, like, long form, you know, investigative journalism was going away in traditional news sources. But at the same time, like, these people are filmmakers with a point of view. So then there's a lot of questions, especially for documentary filmmakers, about, like, how close are you to your subject or to your source material? You know, in those cases where filmmakers are spending, like, years following a family, for example, like, what does that say about their objectivity? And so, like, I feel like documentary is totally going through this moment where it's questioning what role can it play. And at the same time, it's happening at a moment when there's, like, a huge appetite for a documentary, more than we've ever seen before in a public, you know, mainstream way. So it's actually, like, maybe a really interesting time to examine, like, what it means to make a documentary and be a filmmaker on that level.
One additional blurring, just to add to that, is the sort of blurring between objective documentary filmmaking and content creation.
Right.
Because we could say, oh, we watched two documentaries about Fyre Festival, but did we? We watched quasi-documentary, quasi, you know, in the Netflix film, you have Fuck Jerry as a producer, you have the Fuck Jerry content. It feels slick, like a lot of the, it feels like it's the house organ of Firefest. Even if it's dissenting, it still feels like it comes from within. And then obviously the payment of Billy McFarlane, the Hulu documentary. So, like, are these pure documentary in the sense that we have come to understand it? I don't know. I don't want to be fuddy-duddy about it, but I don't know.
Well, the other thing I think is that, like, we're also seeing the sort of cannibalization of certain subjects and subject matters. So we might have two documentaries on this now, but inevitably there will be a dramatization of this, and maybe Adam McKay will direct it. I don't know. But, like, it seems like,
good God.
Is the Lonely Island thing real? Didn't Seth Rogen say he was working on a similar?
Oh, yeah. Maybe that's where I got that idea from. I don't know.
I don't know if it's real or
no,
if
that
he was
is
just
Miles,
like,
Teller available.
Oh, my God. Totally.
Miles Teller as Billy McFarlane.
Seth MacFarlane can play Billy McFarlane.
Oh, yeah. They do look very similar.
They look very much alike.
Yeah. Are we sure they're not related?
I mean, I really, they
Seth,
I mean,
MacFarlane,
they look
a wild scammer.
It does just seem like certain subject matters, we get, like, 8 million different perspectives now. And I do agree that we're kind of coming into this moment where things are changing. And I don't know what to make of what we've seen, but I don't think we've seen the last of it, because the documentaries, everyone's talking about it, we're talking about it, and it is ripe for dramatization.
Well, I would also say that documentary as an art form and as a process has always undergone some kind of self-interrogation. I mean, just before this social media moment, you know, it was the Iraq war and the Bush presidency that had sort of, like, backed the format into a lot of questions about what it was. Was it journalism? Was it storytelling? Was it activism? And what obligation did it have to be functioning in direct opposition to a presidential administration and in two wars. And I think it ruined documentary filmmaking for about 10 years. It's just an art form that is always changing anyway. And it's a filmmaking style that has a lot of different modes. And the one that we're currently in, where you're getting like some of the best looking movies you're ever going to see, but at the same time, they're not capable of going very deep or interested in.
I think part of the answer to your question is the reason these things are rushed out is because we are in a moment of hyper documentation, right?
Right.
And how do you compete with hyper documentation, but with immediacy, gloss? How do you compete with that?
I don't know. I mean, this is like we've entered into some philosophical question, but I actually do think people want stories. And I think that the popularity, if you look at, or like a perspective on something, right? I mean, I think a lot of the popularity of these two movies is that they're immediate. They are really flashy and glossy and have all of the right footage. I don't know if nostalgia can work in 18-month cycles, but I do think it was a negative outpouring of feeling that people are nostalgic to feel in a way that feels entirely wholesome in whom receives it. You know, I mean, I don't know. I feel like we're ready to like hate somebody who really deserves to be hated and where there's no politics, and people who spend money on things and don't get what they paid for because they shouldn't have bought it anyway. It just feels like a really good place to put your bad juju.
So you think it's siphoning off like basically a whole bunch of other built up, and it's a spigot basically.
It's also easier than the Lincoln Memorial situation too. I mean, this that happened like before these movies came out, but I just think morally it's just so much clearer than any of the sort of messier things that we also are dealing with right now. Do I sound crazy?
No.
Yeah, because scams are great, but otherwise no. Should we close out with something that Billy McFarlane had, which are vivid dreams? This is Kate Renata. That's our show. Thank you for listening. Thank you to my guests, Melina Ryzik, Leslie Morris, Aisha Harris. You can listen to every podcast ever at nytimes.com/podcast. Email us if you think that Billy McFarlane is the anti-hero we deserve at podcast@nytimes.com. Wow, I'm just getting nasty looks in the room. Subscribe to Popcast for more fuego takes like this. Anywhere you get your audio content, Google Play, iTunes, Stitcher, etc. Our producer is Pedro Rosado from Head Separate Media. We will be back next week.
Maybe we shouldn't mention my name.
You are tethered to us, whether you like it or not.